from VOA, Press Conference USA. Here is your host, Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our topic on this edition of the program, how autocratic regimes use sharp power to threaten democracies and what can be done to counter it. Our guests, Christopher Walker, he's Vice President for Studies and Analysis at the National Endowment for Democracy. That's an independent nonprofit foundation dedicated to the growth and strengthening of democratic institutions around the world. And Jessica Ludwig, she's Senior Program Officer for the International Forum for Democratic Studies, also with the National Endowment for Democracy. They have both focused their research on the phenomenon of sharp power and how authoritarian regimes wield it both domestically and internationally. Most recently, they co-authored a new report on how globalization has allowed autocracies to use their sharp power to the detriment of global democratic institutions and included recommendations on what can be done to block these actions. The report is entitled A Full Spectrum Response to Sharp Power, The Vulnerabilities and Strengths of Open Societies. In the report, the authors say that, quote, over the last 15 years, authoritarian states, including China and Russia, have begun to wield sharp power, which is characterized by the manipulation of civil society and democratic institutions to help these states accrue power, both domestically and internationally. Government and civil society must work together to fight sharp power, and established democracies must lead the international community's response, especially with technology. Close quote. Christopher Walker and Jessica Ludwig underscored that the success of authoritarian regimes stems from their exploitation of asymmetry, in which autocratic regimes in Russia and China, for example, raise barriers to external political and cultural influence at home while simultaneously preying upon the openness of democratic systems abroad. Christopher Walker and Jessica Ludwig join us via Microsoft Teams to discuss the findings and recommendations in their just released report. Welcome to the program.
Thanks so much, Carol. It's great to be with you.
Thank you, Carol. We're delighted to be here today.
Well, thank you both. So, Christopher, let me start with you. Define in your own words what you mean by sharp power.
So I think our research has found that the sorts of influence that's been exerted on any number of independent institutions in open societies has had characteristics that include limiting free expression, curbing pluralism, and otherwise distorting the political environment. And so that's really been central to this idea. And it was an outgrowth of looking at both with the report we released just recently on June 17th, but also previous work that showed in so many instances when governments and their surrogates from places that themselves restricted free expression, such as China, Russia, the Gulf states, that these characteristics often carried over into open societies. And this is something we felt was underappreciated, didn't have enough focus, and therefore required more debate and discussion.
Jessica, do you have anything to add or subtract to the definition of what you mean by sharp power?
One of the reasons that we decided to use our research to develop this concept was because we found soft power to be an inadequate framing for understanding many of the activities and initiatives that we observed authoritarian governments and political leaders around the world using to exert influence beyond their borders. And these efforts were much more than just merely a charm offensive or an effort to attract foreign audiences through the power of persuasion, but there were these elements, as Chris mentioned, of censorship and manipulation and efforts to suppress pluralism in those activities.
So back to you, Christopher. I'm glad that Jessica brought up the concept of soft power, because that's a concept that we normally associate with democracies, using so-called soft power to win hearts and minds with developing countries. So expand a bit on the contrast between the two. What's the major difference in your view between this sharp power and soft power?
So I think over the years, the commonly understood framing, say used in scholarly analysis and mainstream media in the case of soft power, really oriented around powers of persuasion and attraction, winning hearts and minds, and having independent civil society that would participate in the generation of soft power. And I think the missing piece over the years in this context was when countries like the People's Republic of China, where the authorities focus so assiduously on limiting independent civil society within their own borders, on limiting independent media within their own borders, and even limiting independent commerce, certainly when it applies to the strategic heights of industry in that country, that somehow the soft power framing would fit in those contexts. And I think while some still feel as though that is the right framing, I think it's important to have a debate at a time when China, as well as Russia and the Gulf states, in my view, have become so much more active and engaged internationally in an era of globalization. And their preferences, the preferences of these regimes that dominate in these very well-resourced and now internationally active countries, are better understood because these regimes, as we write in the report we've just released, are not agnostic about things like freedom of expression and freedom of association. They work very, very hard to constrict and limit those values at home and increasingly abroad. I think if we think about the case, say, of Hong Kong and the national security law, which is now being imposed with ruthlessness in what had been an open setting in Hong Kong, it just gives an indication. But I think this is what really needs to be a center of discussion in order that we understand better and then can respond better to the sort of engagement that's emanating from these closed and repressive environments.
And we'll get into more examples later in the conversation. But turning back to you, Jessica Ludwig, both of you have been studying this phenomenon for many years now, sharp power. What, in your view, are the confluence of factors at this historical juncture, about 30 years after the Cold War has ended, that render the threat from sharp power, especially as deployed by Russia and China and even the Gulf states, as Christopher said, increasingly worrisome to the health and welfare of open societies?
Well, maybe I'll start by noting it's not just the current moment in which we're seeing certain factors and dynamics converge, but this has been something that has been in the works for a number of years, going back really to 2006. And from then onward, we began to observe growing assertiveness of authoritarian regimes as they began refining their repressive capacities at home. And during that period, especially over the last 15 years, we've also seen increasing innovations in digitalization, as well as entering into a period of hyperglobalization in which the world is more interconnected than ever before. And as a result, democracies and autocracies are much more tethered than they were at any point in history, really, and especially more so than during the Cold War era. So as a result of these factors, we've seen these authoritarian regimes take advantage of interconnections in the globalized space, such as in the realms of commerce, in broadcasting of international media, in a global information space, in the emergence of new technologies, as well as in a truly international arena for sharing ideas and generating knowledge.
Absolutely. And I'd like now to turn to Christopher, and I'd like you to discuss the problem that you see maybe with democracies, which seem to be turning more inward, just as these authoritarian regimes are turning outward, capitalizing, as Jessica said, on digital technology. We're seeing some strains within democracies, and I assume that that's a problem, is it not? We just saw here in the United States questions about access to voting and assault on our Capitol in January, the insurrection, as it's called. So democracies are also fraying, are they not? And that can't be a good sign.
Carol, I think you've touched on a terribly important point, is that these confluence of factors that have emerged over the last decade and a half include both democratic erosion, but concurrent with authoritarian resurgence. And I think we've also perhaps underestimated the degree to which those factors themselves have been intertwined. And as Jessica rightly notes, this has been, in a sense, turbocharged by the digital revolution, which has enabled communications at some level to offer real opportunities for people to communicate. That's not a question. But I think you also have the sorts of issues we've alluded to in the report that talk about the ways in which debate has become more toxic and can be manipulated more easily, both by domestic forces as well as international forces. So we make the case in the report that we've released that today's challenges can't be viewed as either purely domestic or purely external. And I think a related point to this for what the democracies face, which admittedly are facing real challenges, it's true within the U.S. context, it's true within any number of countries in Europe today and elsewhere, many of which were seen as well on their way to being consolidated democracies or even established democracies that seem to be fraying, that while it's important for the democracies to get their own house in order, they can't ignore the world around them while they do so. And I think this is a very important point, because the risk is if the democracies turn inward and sideline the larger challenges that have emerged to their democratic partners overseas, or to the very real and serious threats that are posed by the authorities in countries like China and Russia, it's very, very unlikely that we'll be able to meet these challenges over time, in my view.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guests are Christopher Walker, from whom you just heard. He's Vice President for Studies and Analysis at the National Endowment for Democracy. And Jessica Ludwig, she's Senior Program Officer for the International Forum for Democratic Studies, also with NED. I'm Carol Castiel. This is a reminder that our Press Conference USA podcast is available for free download on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel, VOA. Well, here's a shout out to one of our most loyal listeners, Johnson Abiwu Glem from Accra, Ghana. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to PCUSA@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to our guests. We're discussing the new report from NED entitled A Full Spectrum Response to Sharp Power, The Vulnerabilities and Strengths of Open Societies. And let me go to the other co-author, Jessica Ludwig. Jessica, I want to pick up on what Christopher was saying before the break about the need for democracies to, in a sense, get their house in order, because we're seeing, you know, erosion of some democratic norms. And yet he's saying that democracies can't wait to do that and then combat sharp power. We need to do both simultaneously. Why is it so vital that established democracies not wait till they're able to rectify problems within their own democracies before they counter forcefully sharp power?
Thank you, Carol. That's a very important question. Democracies can't wait to get their house in order. Democracies, of course, are not perfect. No governance system is. It is important for democracies to recognize that the challenges we're dealing with today cannot be viewed as either purely domestic or purely external issues, particularly just given the era of globalization in which we live. And the world is too intertwined, I think, as the pandemic has revealed. You know, what happens in other parts of the world is very important to what happens within any particular context or country. One of the key points that we make in the report is that democracies need to think about a full spectrum response, and civil society, broadly understood, is a crucial part of democracy's competitive advantage over authoritarian states. Because civil society institutions such as media outlets, universities, think tanks, publishers, technology and entertainment firms, as well as other private sector groups, have been targeted by sharp power, and there is an opportunity for these institutions and organizations to be involved in a purposeful response to authoritarian sharp power. And in fact, many of the strategies that are needed in order to safeguard democratic institutions, as well as these individual civic institutions, from the dangers and the corrosive effects to their integrity that are the result of sharp power, are also the same types of solutions. You know, if they're based on principles, they can help reinvigorate and safeguard democracy and human rights and freedoms globally.
Back to you, Christopher Walker. I wanted to ask you about asymmetry of power, because it seems to me that's extremely important. You discuss asymmetry of power between authoritarian regimes like China, Russia, and even some of the Gulf states like Saudi Arabia. Talk about the power of this asymmetry that allows autocratic regimes that shun a free press and stifle civil society to have greater influence in many ways than democratic societies.
Well, democracies don't operate by controlling all of their institutions. On the contrary, Democracies operate on the basis of pluralism, with a full range of institutions operating with autonomy, whether we're talking about the university sector, the knowledge economy, the tech sector. If we look at any number of the now very internationally minded authoritarian regimes that are in question now, they operate with far more of a unitary approach, which allows them to pursue their goals by aligning media with commerce, with technology, and often with other aspects of the state in ways that simply aren't possible for democracies and frankly shouldn't be what democracies do. The whole idea of having democratic accountability is that will safeguard deeper human freedoms, including personal freedoms, freedom of expression, association, and the like. Precisely the sorts of things that get smothered and cut off in the autocracies. I think what's so worrisome now is that many of the methodologies that have been fine-tuned that we describe in the report that are used by the authorities in the People's Republic of China, Russia, and the like are really exploiting the openness of open societies in ways that is extremely harmful to these critical values of, say, freedom of expression, association, and other civil liberties. And I think this was really grossly underappreciated by the democracies when this new surge of globalization and interaction started going back a generation ago.
So Jessica Ludwig, I wonder if you could give us maybe some concrete examples of the sharp power that we're seeing manifested by, you know, China in particular, whether through the media, maybe the Belt and Road Initiative could be another example of how China is trying to insinuate itself in many countries by offering certain goodies in exchange for, you know, access and contracts and so forth.
Sure. Thank you, Carol. To dig into the issue of how authoritarian regimes such as the People's Republic of China and its authorities, the Chinese Communist Party, are taking advantage of vulnerabilities in open societies. There are so many examples that we could raise in this conversation, but since you mentioned the media, in the reports that we published in our Sharp Power and Democratic Resilience series, one of the authors, Edward Lucas, highlighted how there have been so many disruptions to the information ecosystem. Many media outlets around the world are facing severe financial pressures, and this can render them vulnerable to economic manipulation and coercion in some instances. The other report in our series that focuses on sharp power in the media sphere by Sarah Cook, who is based at Freedom House and has been following China's global influence through the media for many years now, noted how the Chinese Communist Party in particular has developed a four-pronged toolkit for distorting democratic media environments through the dissemination of propaganda, through tools of censorship, through the use of disinformation, as well as mechanisms of control over content delivery systems. In many of these ways, we've observed how surprisingly some of the content that is disseminated, for example, by Chinese state media outlets such as Xinhua or CGTN are able to make their way into a number of surprising places around the world. In many democratic settings, there is a scarcity of economic resources that local media outlets are able to devote to covering China and reporting on China, as well as other international powers that are relevant for their local societies and with which their government might interact. But in the case of China in particular, the Chinese state media outlets have often made their content freely available, and they've pursued partnerships with local media outlets. So one example that we uncovered in the course of research in this series is, for example, in Italy, an agreement signed between Italy's ANSA, one of the major wire news services in the country, and Xinhua has resulted in Xinhua news coverage. And Xinhua is very closely linked to the Chinese Communist Party authorities in China. This content sharing agreement has had the effect, because ANSA is so present in the country, of seeing Xinhua news content effectively dominating coverage about China within Italy's media ecosystem. So this is one example. Also, you mentioned China's activities through the Belt and Road Initiative around the world. This is another initiative that it's become something of a pet project and is very near and dear to Xi Jinping's role and his assertion of power and the way that the PRC is able to project power overseas. Many local governments around the world don't have enough knowledge and information about what the Belt and Road Initiative is. And there's a certain appeal, of course, to the prospect of investments that might come from overseas in a cash-strapped country that is interested, naturally, in trying to deliver infrastructure or other goods for its society. However, what we've observed is that initiatives such as the Belt and Road Initiative and projects that take place under its purview, the prospect of these is so appealing to local governments that they might be willing to make exceptions to their procurement policies and procedures, for example. And these types of agreements, you know, are often framed as investments, but really more often than not are loans given to the country from the Chinese government or Chinese state-linked development banks. There's a problem when there's a lack of debate in local contexts about the utility of such projects or whether or not they are going to, over the long term, be economically viable. And these types of agreements can be lopsided and end up tying a local economy or government to that particular project and, of course, to the Chinese government and its own interests over a longer term period.
So what I'm hearing from you, Jessica, is that there's quite a bit of deception going on the part of Beijing with these types of projects and also the media project. In fact, the VOA did a report on research published by the International Federation of Journalists, which found a rise in the number of countries reporting a visible Chinese presence in their media from like 64% to 76% in 1 year. And the VOA authors reported that in the countries where China offered support and training to local media, a higher percentage said coverage of Beijing was more favorable. So this is what happens.
And Carol, I might add a yes. related point if I could. I think coming back to this idea of how the outreach from a country like China can have this unitary feature, I think it's important to recognize that precisely the sort of media that you just described in many of these settings will be aligned and linked and support the commercial ambitions that come from Chinese firms and Chinese state-owned firms, but also private firms that are obliged to be aligned with Beijing. And we see this in places as diverse as Pakistan, Peru, Kenya, and Montenegro, which is in the news recently for the so-called Road to Nowhere, this billion-dollar project that now has made Montenegro so vulnerable. And as Jessica rightly notes, in so many of these cases, the circumstances by which these extremely large projects come into being often sideline debate from civil society and even from legislatures. And I think that's by design, so that the interlocutors that are engaged from Beijing often are very much a narrow segment of elites in these settings. And it's only after the fact, when the deals are cut and the wheels are already in motion, that wider society learns of the details, which are often not so favorable and can be quite dangerous for the health of those systems.
Indeed. And Chris Walker, I guess the big question now is how can established democracies like in the United States, Europe, concretely help younger, more fragile, and therefore more vulnerable democracies blunt the effects of sharp power? How do we tackle this?
So it's such an important question. And I think one area of focus that we emphasize in the report, I think this is a particularly important point, is that democracies of all kinds are in this together. It's not as though these very large, globally engaged authoritarian regimes have set their sights in just one small slice of the globe. On the contrary, these countries are engaged in just about every part of the world. And so that means that democracies everywhere are facing these challenges and are vulnerable. We make the case that if the wealthier, more established democracies can't achieve essential reforms that can manage and rebuff the compromising effects of sharp power, it really raises questions about the ability of younger democracies that may even be more vulnerable, that they can meet these challenges. And so part of the response, in our view, is that there needs to be new forms of cooperation and intensified cooperation that's interdisciplinary, that's cross-sectoral, that will help accelerate both the learning and the cooperation among democracies. So, for example, in countries where the civil society expertise on China's foreign policy or its commercial firms that seem autonomous but are actually obliged to behave in accordance with the political wishes of the political authorities in Beijing, that civil society really needs to be able to understand these things better and more quickly. And the way to do that is to scale up and deepen initiatives that can help them to do so. And so I think what we would look for is that democracies that are at different levels of development and different stages of awareness to share information and expertise in new ways. This is one basic way that we could get better action and better responses to these things in the near to midterm.
Jessica, turning to you regarding blunting sharp power, combating malign activities by these authoritarian regimes, are you relatively optimistic? Just last week, President Biden was in Europe meeting with the G7, other European powers, and NATO. He met with, of course, Vladimir Putin, one of our adversaries and a big proponent of sharp power. But are you seeing maybe greater willingness, political will among these democracies? Are you relatively optimistic? Do you see a potential greater cooperation given the new leadership we have in the United States?
Thank you, Carol. Well, I think those of us who are in the democracy assistance community, we always have to be looking for opportunities to move forward conversations, particularly where there are severe challenges and threats to human rights and freedoms around the world. And the important thing is now there's greater recognition. There has been much more public debate and attention given to some of these challenges related to sharp power influence, as well as more malign forms of authoritarian interference. And we're now at a moment where both the democratic governments and societies around the world are in a position to move from awareness raising into more concerted efforts and a proactive response. Really, the challenge is for civil society institutions, in particular in democracies, to start thinking proactively about ways to reaffirm their commitment to democratic standards, to how they can protect free expression. For example, even in the private sector, there's a huge opportunity just because of attention that's been given to efforts by the Chinese Communist Party and other PRC government entities to apply pressure to international businesses that have spoken up, for example, saying that they will not source products that involve the forced labor by members of the Uyghur minority in Xinjiang Autonomous Region. Both businesses in the private sector, as well as a whole range of other institutions, need to be thinking about the non-financial costs of financial engagement or closer interaction with counterparts within authoritarian countries like China.
Chris Walker, I'm going to give you the last word. Do you see greater receptivity among the world's democracies, notwithstanding their own shortcomings, to the threat that sharp power poses? And do you see perhaps we may be on the precipice of coordinating more closely and thereby increasing influence to counter sharp power by China, Russia, and, for example, Saudi Arabia and other authoritarian regimes?
So I think the signal sent with the president's visit to Europe and so many senior officials, U.S. senior officials, putting democracy in a more central role is terribly impressive and striking. And it really is important for that signal to be sent. The autocrats are all too happy to have these sorts of discussions set aside entirely and operate purely on a transactional basis, which plays to their strengths. The democracy's strengths and our competitive advantage is democratic accountability, openness, and these other central values to democracies. And so it's a very good thing that this has been recentered in the discussion on that count. And I think that in and of itself will start to get our partners moving in the right direction. They'll see the signal coming from the U.S. and as part of a wider recognition of the threat, which is out there. And I think there's much more awareness of the threat, start to get more meaningful responses. The final point we make in our report is that there have been very, very important strides made in the recent past to raise awareness about the sorts of challenges that have come in the modern forms of authoritarian influence that have started to impact adversely open societies. And I think now we've reached the stage where we need to translate and transform that heightened awareness into more concerted action. And a big part of this will flow from greater democratic unity to respond to the divide and conquer tactics that are the bread and butter of the authoritarians, whether we talk about at the state level, the international level, or at the level of the sort of democratic institutions that we focused on in our just released report.
The report is a full spectrum response to sharp power, the vulnerabilities and strengths of open societies. The authors Christopher Walker and Jessica Ludwig, both with the National Endowment for Democracy. Christopher and Jessica, I can't thank you enough for your time and terrific research and insights on this very important topic. Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Rick Pantaleo. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.